compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we are back. Thanks for listening to the program. We will be getting some of your phone calls here coming up right quick. I thought you might be edified by this story, though. I was. And I don't really know anything about Chris Tucker, famous actor. In fact, according to the Daily Wire, Chris Tucker was once one of the highest paid actors, if not the highest paid actor in the world. I mean, I guess that would beat out people like Tom Cruise and, you know, whoever the other like super highly paid people are. Chris Tucker, you've heard of Chris Tucker, right? Because he's been in some of the action movies.
Yeah, I've heard the name. My son probably knows more about him than I do.
Which may not be a good thing.
I don't know. Again, it's probably an action movie he hasn't seen because I pay pretty close attention to what
Jackie
he sees.
Jackie Brown?
Yeah. No.
Rush Hour?
No.
Ring
the Bells? He hasn't seen that, so.
Okay. Tons of people have seen them. Yeah, I don't think your 10-year-old should be seeing those.
I'm getting myself in trouble here now.
Yeah. We'll make a note of it, you know, and hey, son, you never saw Jackie Brown, did you? So anyway, Chris Tucker, he was the star of, you know, back in the 90s, blockbuster movies like Jackie Brown and Rush Hour, big action franchise. And I just thought this article was really cool because Ice Cube, a rapper, I couldn't tell you anything about him. I know he's famous. I know I've heard the name. I couldn't, to save my own life, tell you what his music is, but that's okay. It doesn't matter. He said on Twitter this past week, he says that he offered Chris Tucker, the actor in question, a huge payday to reprise the role of Smokey in a sequel to the 1995 comedy Friday, but the comedian passed on the offer because of his religious convictions. So Ice Cube said, "We were ready to pay Chris Tucker $10 to $12 million to do Next Friday," that's the sequel movie, "but he turned us down for religious reasons. And the reasons were, among others, that he didn't want to cuss or smoke weed on camera anymore." Now, I don't know if that means that he does that off camera. I have a feeling it means he doesn't do that off camera. According to a YouTube documentary on the channel Comedy Hype, as well as Tucker's own stand-up comedy sets, once the highest paid actor in the world, he was raised in a Pentecostal household. His parents regularly took him to church. He wandered away from the faith once his comedy career took off. But when he moved back to Atlanta in the 90s, he became a born-again Christian. Various reports hold that at that point he became much more selective about the roles he accepted. Among the films he is rumored to have turned down was Any Given Sunday and Lethal Weapon 4. In a 2014 interview with a Canadian paper, he revealed that his faith had led him to return to his first professional love, which was stand-up comedy. He says, "Being a Christian helps me in comedy. I have to talk about other stuff. Normally, most comics talk about stuff that's easy, maybe cussing or saying something raunchy. I have to dig deeper to find something that's still funny but not raunchy. It's harder, and I like the challenge." Tucker's faith also led him to buck the typical left-wing talking points of his industry. In 2018, in an interview, he said that he was praying for the president to do a good job. He said that he prayed for him. That drove some people absolutely wild with anger. Social media's users who are generally impressed with Tucker's decision to forego continued stardom in order to stand by his convictions, a Forbes contributor said on social media, "Respect." Another pop culture pundit said, "I wish I had that kind of discipline. I love Jesus, but I could buy a lot of lipo with that kind of money." Now, Jim, help me out here. Lipo, I interpret that to mean liposuction. I don't know.
That's what my interpretation would be as well.
Okay, so lipo doesn't stand for something else like real estate or nice cars or something like that?
Not that I recall.
Okay. I mean, of all the things to buy with that kind of money, I don't think lipo would be high on most people's list. Maybe some people, I don't know. But I mean, isn't that kind of sad that that guy said, I'm not giving his name, "I wish I had that kind of discipline. I love Jesus, but I could buy a lot of lipo with that money." So in other words, sure, that's my price. Heck yeah. If you gave me $10 to $12 million to do a movie, this is what he's essentially saying. If you give me $10 to $12 million to do a movie that's going to involve me being raunchy and smoking weed and swearing and who knows what else. Yeah, sure. That's my price. Isn't that what a prostitute is? Where you sell yourself at, you know, I mean, you set your price. Oh, I would never do it for that. That's way too low. But when the price gets to where you say, okay, I'd do it for that, that's prostitution. Man, I don't want to be anywhere near that kind of an exit interview where you have to answer to Jesus at the end of your life in the exit interview when you're giving an account of your life. And one of the line items that Jesus asks you about is the time that you said, well, I love Jesus, but I would be willing to do all kinds of those things for the money. And this guy won't do it. Now, some people are saying, oh, yeah, well, he flew, and this is going back to Chris Tucker. He flew, they're pointing out, on Jeffrey Epstein's private jet. They found one time when he flew on it. And so they're saying, yeah, look at him. He's just a hypocrite because everybody knows what Jeffrey Epstein was up to. But in fact, that's a red herring because he was actually going with Epstein on a humanitarian aid trip to Africa. So the article points out there have been zero allegations, zero evidence of any kind that Tucker participated in any of the insanity and the immorality that Epstein was involved in. Just so happens that he said, hey, I'll give you a ride to, you know, Africa to, so you can help the kids. And he did. So I think that's something to cheer for. Who knows? Maybe he'll come all the way into the Catholic Church. Wouldn't that be great? 888-914-9149. How about Matt now in Colorado Springs? Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Patrick. I've been having an online conversation with a Protestant friend. I think she's non-denominational, Bible only, for several weeks. And the conversation has covered several topics, Marian doctrine, sola scriptura. The latest thing is, you know, I was trying to find common ground with her, but she's saying that, you know, your church has damned me 10 times over if I look at the canon law. And specifically, she's looking at canon law, I think 1, 2, and 3 is what she said, where if I don't believe the Eucharist is the body of Christ, I am anathema. If I don't believe the priest can forgive sins, I am anathema. And I've never heard that response to Catholicism before.
I can explain it
to you. I'm wondering how to respond.
Okay, yeah, there's some confusion at some point along the way because she's not referring to canon law, although she may think she is, but she's not. She's probably referring to the canons and decrees of the Council of Trent. Does that sound more like what you heard her talk about?
Yeah, it did. It did sound familiar to older, laws that I'd heard. Yeah.
Okay. So here's her confusion. The term anathema sit, which is used repeatedly in the Latin of the code of the canons and decrees of the Council of Trent, as it was with the other councils. Obviously there were some that were in Greek early on. But in any case, that formula is used to say, let that person be cut off. It does not mean, never has meant, doesn't mean that somebody is damned to hell. That's a common Protestant misunderstanding because they don't know the language or they don't know what the language means in context. So it's a legal penalty that is prescribed for somebody, and it's specifically referring not to those who are not Catholic, but it's referring to Catholics who were to say, so as let's say the canon says, if anyone should say that, and then it gives the proposition, you know, that Mary was not a perpetual virgin, let him be anathema sit. That is a penalty that applies to Catholics, does not apply to non-Catholics. So that's another confusion on her part. So no, it does not mean being damned to hell. No, it does not refer, at least in context anyway, to those who are outside of the church as she is. It's referring specifically to those Catholics. Now, it doesn't negate the fact that she is still adhering to a heresy, even though, formally speaking, she herself is not a heretic. Because in order to be a heretic, you have to be a Catholic who dissents from some teaching of the faith and then obstinately refuse to believe it and then fall away into heresy. I'm guessing it probably doesn't describe her. So she's confused on those two points. And a third part is that the anathema is another way of referring to excommunication. Now, excommunication is a medicinal penalty that's intended to do exactly the opposite of damning somebody to hell. Rather, it's intended to get somebody's attention so that they won't be damned to hell. So when the church says, I'm sorry, you're excommunicated, and this happens very rarely nowadays, it's like the last ditch effort. We've tried everything. We've reasoned with you. We've talked with you. We've explained it to you. We've prayed for you. We've encouraged you. And if you persist in doing this, we have no other choice but to follow the Lord's commandment in Matthew chapter 18, where he said, if you have something against your brother, bring it to him in private. And if you can win him over, great, you've won over your brother. But if he won't listen to you, bring two or three witnesses so that everything will be established in the presence of two or three witnesses. But if he won't listen to them, take it to the church, Jesus says. And you can almost imagine maybe a hint of exasperation in the Lord's voice when he says, but if he will not listen even to the church, then treat him as a Gentile or a tax collector. Now that is a phrase, not only in the language, but also in the custom of the Jews at that time. That meant you were cut off. You were anathematized. That's what the word anathema means, to be cut off or to be excommunicated in a stricter sense. So Jesus himself gives this very principle. It's not as though it's the Catholic Church pulling a rabbit out of a hat and doing something that, you know, is unique unto itself. The church is following the paradigm set down by Jesus Christ. And if a Catholic finds himself in that situation, that's what the church does. So my advice would be, share these things with her. Let her know that even though she may still object to whatever given issue it may be, for the moment at least, she's objecting to it for the wrong reasons, because she misunderstands it. And maybe with this clarification, you can help her understand it. Now, on the positive side, I would suggest give her a good book. Give her a book like Surprised by Truth. Full disclosure, I edited that book. But I must say, it's very powerful. The testimonies in this book are very powerful in reaching people just like this woman, who are so convinced that their objections to the Catholic Church are ironclad. It never even occurs to them that maybe they're wrong. So a book like Surprised by Truth can help to show her that these 11 people who tell their testimonies in this book, they used to think just like she did. They had some of the same exact convictions as she does now, and they discovered the truth and they wound up becoming Catholic. So that might be the follow-up to share a book like that with her. I hope that helps, Matt. Thank you. Let's go now to Michelle in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question for you. Sure. I have been very interested and delighted in watching The Chosen. And there was a recent Christmas enactment of The Chosen where it showed that Mary was in birth pains. And there on the Facebook pages, there's been a lot of going back and forth about the virgin birth. And in fact, did Mary did she have labor pains? And I don't know the answer to that question, except when I look at Revelation chapter 12 with the woman and the dragon,
right?
And I always thought that the woman was Mary, so perhaps I'm incorrect.
No, you're not.
Okay, it says she was with child and she cried out in her pangs of birth in anguish right. for delivery.
Right.
So I'm not really sure. I don't know what I'm supposed to believe, and is it?
I can tell you.
So help me.
Yeah, I can tell you. So keep in mind that the doctrine that this pivots upon is that of Mary's perpetual virginity, meaning that she remained a virgin before, during, and after the birth of Jesus. And that phraseology is important because that's the specific formula that the church has used repeatedly in its both defining the dogma but also reaffirming the dogma. So Mary's perpetual virginity was never violated or suspended. Now, virginity, obviously, I don't think it's necessary to explain specifically what it is all about, but that can be understood in two ways. One would be the change. Follow me here, Michelle, and you would know this even better than I, but the change in the integrity of the woman's body when it comes to not only childbirth, but what leads up to childbirth, there is a certain change that takes place. And medically speaking, it can be determined just on the basis of that particular issue whether or not a woman is a virgin. But that's not the sum total of what virginity means. Virginity also, and maybe most importantly, refers to the lack of certain activity that would give rise to conception. And you follow what I'm saying here. So that being the case, the church's emphasis on Mary's perpetual virginity focuses on the latter issue. And that is that there was no human father involved at any step along the way, in any way whatsoever, in the miraculous conception of Jesus. This was something that God did miraculously in the womb of the Blessed Virgin Mary. So this is what we call the virgin birth. But the church says that she remained a virgin for the rest of her life. So when it comes to the question of childbirth, the church just simply passes over that question in a discreet silence because it doesn't know, because God did not reveal that to us. There was no need that I can see for God to reveal those specifics to us. It's enough to know that in whatever manner it was that Our Lady delivered Jesus, that her virginity was intact and inviolate from beginning to end. Now, could it mean that she experienced pain in childbirth? It certainly could. There are some church fathers who held that view. And it would be in a way similar to how Jesus, of course, did not need to die because he was not subject to the condition of original sin. He was free from original sin, being God, being pure and holy. And yet, he willingly accepted one of the penalties of original sin for our salvation, even though he was not subject to it. So theologically speaking, it's entirely possible that the Blessed Virgin Mary herself also submitted to one of the penalties of original sin as explained by the Lord in Genesis chapter 3, one of which was pain in childbirth. So it's entirely consistent, if in fact that's what happened, and it may well have been, we don't know, but if Mary experienced pain in childbirth, as it's described in Revelation chapter 12, verse 1 and forward, that would not in any way injure the fact that she remained a virgin perpetually. Now, it's also possible, and other church fathers have held this view, that maybe there was some miraculous manner of birth. And one example that has been given is like a ray of light passing through a pane of glass. It literally passes through the glass, but it doesn't break it. So some have theorized that perhaps God did something like that for her. But ultimately, and this is where I'll have to leave it, ultimately we don't know, and no one knows. And anyone who says that they know really doesn't know, because it's not part of divine revelation. So if the Chosen, I haven't seen that episode, I've only seen one episode, but if the Chosen sought to depict Mary's childbirth in that way, we're free to assume that that could have happened. Nobody is obliged to believe one way or the other. Both possibilities are possible. But that's all that would be, is just simply trying to assume or think about what might have happened, as long as we recognize that ultimately we'll find out when we get to heaven. But in the meantime, God did not choose to reveal that to us. That's enough for me. Personally, I feel very satisfied with that. How does that feel?
And I'm
how does that sound?
And you know what? I really like that, Patrick, because, and I'll just take up maybe 10 more seconds of your time. It's caused a lot of riff, I would say, that I think is unnecessary, because I think I totally espouse to what you say. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jesus did suffer, and he didn't have to do that. He didn't have original sin. So we don't know what God's plan is. But, we'll know what we should know when we get to heaven. But in the meantime, right. I don't think that in Brothers and Sisters of Christ, we should be taking these little tiny points and making them into something that really takes away from the beauty of believing in Christ.
I agree.
In this particular instance. So,
I totally agree. So we're on the same page. Yeah, we are. If God did not see fit to reveal it to us, who am I to question that? You know, this is God's revelation, and I'll be happy to bide my time. We'll see if we find these things out in heaven. Thank you, Michelle. More to come right after this. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
This is The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
Talk about ridiculous, stupid stunts. MSN reporting over the weekend, men across America are getting vasectomies as an act of love. And this is because of the changes in the law, and maybe even the, God willing, the overturning of Roe versus Wade. May we all live to see that day. I hope it happens this year. They give some examples. After Andy and Aaron Gress had their fourth child, Andy decided it was time for him to step up and help with the family planning. So he did something that the mere thought of makes men cringe. He got a vasectomy. And then they go into all the, you know, they were juggling kids in school, and he decided on World Vasectomy Day, I'm going to make an appointment and get snipped. And he did. His wife had taken birth control pills, but she struggled with the side effects. She had worked as a night nurse through four pregnancies, and the couple had children ranging in age from 2 to 11. He says the procedure was a total relief, almost like the COVID shot, like I'm safe now. He says, I wanted to man up. So they're sort of couching it in that way. And it's all against the backdrop of Roe versus Wade going away, which, God willing, it will go away. And maybe even this year it'll go away if the Supreme Court renders its decision on that case that we talked about, which I believe is going to be given maybe in May or June of this year. In which case, and some people say, yeah, but that won't stop abortion. Of course, it's not going to stop abortion. You're new to this party if you think it will. No, it's going to go back to the states. Now, thankfully, at least about half of these United States are going to completely outlaw abortion. Completely. So some states, Georgia, Ohio, many others, thankfully are going to do the right thing and outlaw abortion. How can I forget Texas? But other states that are out of control, in more ways than one, California and New York, for example, they're going to ensure, they're going to be what they refer to it as sanctuary states. So you can't kill this innocent person in that state, but come on over here. We'll kill him for you because that's just our value system. You want an innocent person killed? No problem. You can't get that innocent person killed where you are? No problem. Come here. We'll kill that innocent person for you. That's what this amounts to. So anyway, so these goofballs, trying to choose my words as I go, they think they're doing acts of love. It's acts of selfishness and stupidity, if you ask me. And if somebody says, "Well, wait, doesn't a man and his wife, husband and wife, don't they have the right to decide how many children?" Yeah, of course they do. They absolutely do. The Catholic Church upholds that. The Catholic Church doesn't tell any couple, "You got to have this many kids." All the Catholic Church says is, and we're talking here about Catholics, is enjoy the pleasure and the wonders of the marital act within marriage. It's there for you. It's like Adam and Eve in the garden. Just think, God turned Adam and Eve loose in the garden, naked, by the way, with all the food and all the sunshine and all the wonderful things. Who knows what all was in that garden? I don't know. It hasn't been revealed to us. But whatever it was, I'm sure it was very, very fun and delightful. All the things that God gave to Adam and Eve in the garden. So he turned them loose. He basically said, have fun, enjoy. Just that tree right there, yeah. Don't eat the fruit off that tree. That's the one thing. Everything here is for you except for that one thing. That's not for you. Okay. God leaves. What do? They eat the fruit of that tree. So in an analogous way, in a way similar to that, God ordained sexuality in marriage to be enjoyed, to be treasured, to be celebrated, etc., etc. We don't have to go too far in that direction, and you understand what I'm talking about. But the point here is it comes with responsibility. So it is a great gift, but also bears with it a certain responsibility. And for the goofy people, the goofy guys who think that they're doing something, you know, they're manning up. Actually, you're manning down, by the way. You're manning way down because you are reducing your full masculinity thereby. But in any case, they think they're manning up. They think they're striking a blow for feminism or defending women or something. It's all ridiculous. It's just selfishness and stupidity because it's a way of enjoying the pleasure without the responsibility. So a real man, if you ask me, and this is just my opinion, but a real man would say, you know what? I've been blessed with a lovely wife and a happy marriage, and God has given us some children. And at this point, it doesn't seem as though, for health reasons or financial reasons, that having another baby at this point is a good idea. So we're going to practice self-control. And a very easy way to do that is NFP. And, you know, charting and all of the observation methods. Those of you who have done NFP, you know how the very, very high accuracy that is involved when it comes to knowing when the fertile time of the month is. And then you avoid those activities that could lead to conception. And then when the fertile time of the month ends, then you resume those activities. Problem solved. Easy peasy lemon squeezy. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. It just works. So, that's what a real man would do, if you ask me. So anyway, that's happening. It's a phenomenon now. And these guys are boasting because they think it's so cool. Now, wait, there's more. And not on that topic, though. I think I'm pretty much done with that topic. Another topic we've talked about, though, is that a man who is swimming as a woman, Leah Thomas, competed as a male for 3 years in college swimming. I guess couldn't make it in a man's world. So switched and decided to start competing as a woman, identifying as a woman, competing as a woman. And as you've heard me talk about on the program before, it's grossly unfair to the women athletes against whom he is competing because he's winning all the meets. He's breaking all the records. He wasn't that good by comparison to the really good swimmers who were men. He really wasn't that good compared to them. So he couldn't make it in that world, apparently. So he found a way to game the system. So now he's destroying all the women's records in college, women's college swimming, even though he's not a woman. And so there's been a growing hue and cry. And the most recent voice to join that chorus, her name is Cynthia Millen. She has officiated at USA swimming events for 30 years, but she resigned in protest over this guy who's a Penn transgender swimmer. She says that she hopes others in the sport will follow her lead. This is an article from the Daily Wire. Millen told the outlet, this is referring to the Washington Times, that she notified USA Swimming of her resignation in a letter saying that she made the decision while packing for the U.S. Paralympic Swimming National Championship. She said, I can't do this. I can't support this. She said, I told my fellow officials that I can no longer participate in a sport which allows biological men to compete against women. Everything fair about swimming is being destroyed. The Daily Wire reported Thomas, and this is Leah Thomas, the person in question, swims for the times while swimming for the men's team would break 7-time gold medal Olympic champion Katie Ledecky's college times. Millen told the Times that if she had to officiate at a swim meet where Thomas competed, she would have to rule the senior ineligible to compete as a woman. And she said in this interview, if Leah came on my deck as a referee, I would pull the coach aside and say, Leah can swim, but Leah can't swim, but she can swim exhibition or time trial. But Leah cannot compete against those women because that's not fair. So she's calling on other women officials in the sport to do likewise. And I hope she's successful. Also, just as an example of the insanity, in the way in which the modern secular press tries to hide the insanity from people. Good example. This is from the New York Times. Headline, Amy Schneider wins the most consecutive Jeopardy games of any female contestant. You're like, wow, that's great. Good for you, Amy. It took 16 paragraphs. I counted them when I read the New York Times article. It took 16 paragraphs before they got to the actual lead, L-E-D-E, for you journalists out there. The lead was buried 16 paragraphs into the article, and the lead says, Ms. Schneider, a transgender woman, lives in Oakland with her girlfriend, Genevieve. That's the reality of the whole art. It's not a woman who won Jeopardy, the most consecutive Jeopardy games. They hide the fact that this is a transgender, quote unquote. Well, you get the idea, right? Why do they have to hide that? I'll tell you why. Because they know that if they put that right up in the very first paragraph, which says, when Amy Schneider was an eighth grader in Dayton, Ohio, her fellow students voted her most likely to appear on Jeopardy. They underestimated her. Second paragraph, on Wednesday, Ms. Schneider, 42, an engineering manager from Oakland, California, became the first woman in the show's history to achieve 21 consecutive wins, surpassing Julia Collins, who had set the record for 20 wins in 2014. And it goes on and on and on about extolling, you know, the knowledge, etc. I mean, obviously, this person is very knowledgeable, but it's not a woman. And so they took the very core of the story and they buried it, I guess, maybe thinking that not everybody would get 16 paragraphs into the story before they gave up. But if they had put that little detail in the very first paragraph, and then you'd look at that and you'd say, wait a minute, it says of any female contestant. But there's an asterisk there in the minds of everybody because, well, you get the idea, right? This is the way in which so much of this deception is being perpetrated on people because they don't want you to connect the dots. They don't want you to draw certain conclusions. That's my read on it. One more thing before we go to the phones. This is on social media. I saw it on social media. There was a headline that apparently appeared in the New York Times, and I'm looking at the headline here. It says, opinion, teachers should tolerate bullying towards unvaccinated children. Subhead, as heartless as it may sound, it may be the only way to encourage parents to make the right choice. People were retweeting this and condemning it and how terrible that is. And if it were real, it would be worthy of condemnation, but it wasn't real. So Reuters, they have an interesting article. You probably saw this if you're on social media, especially if you, you know, maybe follow conservative social media accounts. That's where I saw it typically. They did a fact check, and here's what they found out. This image purporting to show a screenshot of an opinion piece published by the New York Times calling for teachers to tolerate bullying towards unvaccinated children was digitally altered. Big surprise, right? No such headline or article was published by the outlet. The New York Times branding is visible at the top of the image with a headline that reads, teachers should tolerate bullying towards unvaccinated children. One user who shared the screenshot on Twitter said, you won't want a parent-teacher conference with me if this happens to my child. Another individual who posted that image on Facebook said, it is a weird time in history. Other examples of the image shared on social media, they give in the article so you can see them for yourself. New York Times, for its part, confirmed to Reuters that the outlet did not publish that or any other similar headline. And Reuters, you know, did a deep dive, as they say, through the archives, and they could not find any article of that type at all. So they give a few ways in this article, if you're interested in how you can detect something that is not real. It's becoming increasingly difficult to do. But before we go to our break and before we go back to phone calls, I want to share with you just a few minutes long. It's going to take us up to the next break. This is from a school board meeting, and this gentleman here he's lit up. He's on fire. He's a dad. He's angry. I'm assuming he's a naturalized citizen because he has a British accent, but he's an American citizen now, and he is just tearing into the school board for their malfeasance and the nonsense that this particular school board seems to be perpetrating on the students, and he's had enough of it, and here's what he had to say. Take a listen.
If you don't like living in the United States of America, then you can all move to Russia, Cuba, or China.
So you've probably been seeing a lot of clips of brave parents starting to stand up against critical race theory at school board meetings across the nation. But this one might just be the best one. Check it out.
Simon Campbell, 1571 Brookfield Road, Lower Makefield Township. I'm a Pensbury School District resident, Pensbury School District taxpayer. I'm also a former member of the Governing Board of Directors, 2009 to 2013. It's nice to see the old faces. I'm here to speak today. I believe, Gary, you said it was item KKK in the agenda book. Well, isn't that just a perfect, perfect summation of what it is I'm here to talk about? KKK, your proposed new school board policy, seeking once again to limit the constitutionally protected speech of American citizens. Now, when I sat on this school board, I believe some of you old-timers might remember this. A union guy spoke at public comment for 5 minutes and ripped me a new one. He called me the child of Margaret Thatcher. And I sat there and I said to myself, okay, fair enough. Welcome to America. He considers me a because I'm in the government. His logic is sound. Now, what happened was the superintendent and the school solicitor at the time freaked out and they didn't put the tape online the next day. And I called them up and I said, get the tape online now before we get sued for censorship. I yelled at the solicitor and I asked him what law school he went to, because it was clearly constitutionally protected rhetorical hyperbole. I can cite the case if you'd like. And I said to Paul Long, the superintendent at the time, don't ever cut the tape again, Paul. And by the way, child of Margaret Thatcher, I took it as a compliment. Now, you snowflakes apparently have a bigger problem with public comment. It seems to me that you think you can supersede the United States Constitution. Well, I've got news for you, school board president Benito Mussolini. Your power does not supersede that of the US Constitution and the First Amendment rights of the citizens of this great nation. Let's be very, very clear who has the power.
Mr.
It is
Campbell,
not government policy. Do not warn me or do not interrupt my time.
That if you make personal insults like that again, or if you personally direct your comments, you will
be
asked to step away from the podium.
I'm going to quote to you,
Solicitor. Make your comments,
but do not do name
calling like
you
just did.
This is my comment, not your comment. I'm quoting to you now from the United States Supreme Court 1964 case, New York Times versus Sullivan. This is constitutional case law in this country, and I'm quoting you from the U.S. Supreme Court. The judges wrote that this nation is founded on the, quote, profound national commitment to the principle that debate on public issues shall be uninhibited, robust, and wide open, and that it may well include vehement, caustic, and sometimes unpleasantly sharp attacks on government and public officials. That's constitutional case law in this nation. I don't have to be nice to you. Nobody behind me has to be nice to you. If you don't like living in the United States of America, then you can all move to Russia, Cuba, or China. This is the First Amendment. And I will caution you, Solicitor. There is a video camera to my left. If you edit this tape, then you're going to have a big legal problem on your hands, because my right to critique your fascism, which is what this is constitutionally protected. There are emails, public record emails, in which the Director of Equity is lobbying and advocating for public comment to be censored in this school district. And you know what? You know what? Lobbying for it, advocating for it. We've got the school board president saying she'll do better at hitting the mute button in blatant violation of the Constitution. For her lobbying and her advocacy of unconstitutional censorship, I want you, the school board, to terminate the employment of Dr. Charissa Gibson with immediate effect. After you've terminated her employment, I want all of you to tender your resignations for hating on this country. We have a God-given constitutional right to critique you, and we can speak in any lawful tone that we see fit. And don't go looking around, Benito, because this is the United States of America. You have a good... One more thing. I want to make a verbal request right now for an unedited copy of the tape. So if any of you delete it, you're going to have a big legal problem. Good night.
So that's one mad dad at a recent school board meeting. I'll just let you bask in that afterglow. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Oh, yeah. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. Thanks for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. And Happy New Year. Let's go to Jean in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Good morning, Jean.
Good morning, Patrick. First of all, I want to say thank you for Relevant Radio and thank you for you. I've been listening since day one.
Thank you.
And I will continue to listen.
Makes me happy.
I have a question that's really confusing me. My son had gotten a divorce, and he stopped going to church. He wants to go to church to receive communion, but he's told that he can't. Mm-hmm. But yet, I don't understand how the Pope says that the president can okay abortions or go to communion after. Mm-hmm. I don't understand that.
I think your perplexity is one that I and many, many other people who are looking at this share. Many of us are scratching our heads and wondering, well, why? Let's start with your son, first of all. Your son, regardless of his circumstances with a divorce, could indeed receive Holy Communion if he, number one, went to confession and was in the state of grace. That's necessary for anybody. If you are in the state of mortal sin and you want to receive Holy Communion, right, you have to go to confession first. So in his case, he could do that. But the other thing I'm guessing is he's probably remarried. Would that be a fair guess?
Say that again, I'm sorry.
Did your son who got divorced, did he remarry?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, even better. So if he had been remarried, the remedy there would be that he would have to make the difficult but possible decision to live as brother and sister with his wife as opposed to living the way married people do, in which case he would not be committing the kind of sin that would prevent him from going to Holy Communion, so he could go to Holy Communion. But in his case, if he didn't remarry and he's not romantically involved with any other woman, he's certainly able to receive Holy Communion once he goes to confession. So it seems like this is a rather common misconception that people have, thinking that just because they got a divorce that the church has shut the door on them, but that's not true. So that's the first part.
Okay.
Second part is the perplexity that many Catholics experience as to why, on the one hand, does the church's law, and I've opened the Code of Canon Law to the pertinent paragraph, it's paragraph 915, those who have been excommunicated or interdicted after the imposition or declaration of the penalty, and others obstinately persevering in manifest grave sin, are not to be admitted to Holy Communion. A person, paragraph 916, a person who is conscious of grave sin is not to celebrate Mass or receive the body of the Lord without previous sacramental confession, unless there is a grave reason and there is no opportunity to confess. This is referring in the case of a priest who has an obligation to celebrate Mass, but maybe he hasn't gone to confession yet. But it's referring to people who are conscious of serious sin. Now, one category is those who have been excommunicated. Another category would be those who have an interdict that had been pronounced against them, forbidding them from receiving the sacraments. Or it says, others obstinately persevering in manifest grave sin are not to be admitted to Holy Communion. I don't personally see how being a public politician, Catholic politician, especially if you're the president of the United States and you are steeped in your support for abortion, the heinous, wanton killing of unborn innocent life. I mean, talk about a grave sin. Talk about persisting or persevering in this manifest grave sin. On the one hand, the church's law says you can't go to Holy Communion. You're not to be admitted to Holy Communion, because that there is a reference to the minister of Holy Communion, not to the communicant himself. So the minister of Holy Communion, under the church's law, has an obligation to say, I'm sorry, no, you can't receive for this reason. So you're raising a question that I wish I had an answer to, but I don't. Why is it that President Biden, for example, is permitted to receive Holy Communion when he makes a state visit to the Holy See? He's permitted to receive Holy Communion, given his staunch and unwavering support for the wanton killing of innocent unborn life at every turn. And yet when a couple gets divorced and maybe there's a remarriage situation, rightly so, the man or the woman is told you can't go to communion until you get yourself right with God. So in the second situation, that's the correct application of the church's law. In the first situation, I don't understand why the church's law is not applied the same way. And it doesn't make any sense to me. So I wish I could say Here's the reason why, but I don't see a reason why, quite honestly, Joanne.
Right. All right. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time today.
You're most welcome.
And picking that gentleman that talked on the school committee, that was awesome.
He was a fireball, wasn't he?
Yes, he certainly was. And I wish there were more people that could speak up that eloquently to just school boards.
I agree. Well, that's why we wanted to bring him to you. And if you're interested in seeing the video, because it's a video, actually, you'll find it on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Our Twitter feed for the show is embedded on the show page. So you can find everything there. Go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Thank you. I appreciate it very much. Let's go now to Araceli in the Bay Area of California. Good morning, Araceli.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question. At Mass, during Mass, are we supposed to mimic the priest motions?
No.
Okay. My friend and I have noticed a lot of parishioners doing that.
Well, it's possible that they're mimicking the priest's actions. Now, the priest, there are certain gestures that the priest makes that are unique to his office as a priest offering sacrifice at the altar. But what you might be seeing is, I remember when this first really arose, it was in the early 1970s, I was in high school, and seemingly out of nowhere, all of a sudden it seemed that people, when the priest would say, the Lord be with you, and in the response, and with your spirit, people would stick their hands out, like, you know, as if they were handing him something. So it was a gesture of response to when the priest would say, the Lord be with you. They would do this gesture. I had never seen it done before. And it really wasn't done before. I don't know which doorway it came in, maybe through the nascent charismatic renewal door, perhaps, I don't know. But it started and it became very fashionable, along with other aberrations like holding hands during the Our Father, that's an aberration. Or, you know, for thine is the kingdom and the power. Then people would join hands and lift them up, you know, up in the air. It became a big fad. And what's interesting, Araceli, is that the people who are now in their 70s, late 60s in their 70s, they're sort of aging out in terms of, you know, that seems to be the generation that really glommed onto these things in the 1970s. And they've kept doing that all along. And now as they are, you know, fading away in terms of that demographic, you're beginning to see these gestures beginning to disappear. And personally, I think it's a good thing to see them disappear because they're not an organic part of the church's liturgical tradition. And they sort of came and now they're going. And I would think after I'm gone, probably in another 40, 50 years, you probably won't see them at all, would be my guess. I think they'll just simply fade away. But that might be what you're seeing.
But one more. It's where my friend and I have been noticing more of mimicking more of the priest gestures. When he raises his hand, when he puts his hand up.
Yeah, they should not do
like,
that.
More than the, okay.
Yeah, it's, you know what it is, Araceli? It's an innocent idiosyncrasy. That's all it really is. I don't attribute any malice to anybody, you know, who does that. They just, I think maybe in their own minds, they feel as though they're somehow participating more closely or something. And that's a good thing to want to participate more closely. But lay people do not have the sacrament of holy orders. The men who have that sacrament, they have certain duties that are proper to that state in life that are not proper to lay people. And so mimicking the gestures, or I've even seen some people or heard them from time to time saying some of the words that the priests say at the altar, like the Eucharistic prayer or the peripsum, you know, through him, with him, and in him, they'll say that. And those are words that are proper only to the priest, not to the people in the congregation. But I think because they don't know and no one's ever explained it to them, that they're just innocently doing it in good faith. I don't foresee any malice in a situation like that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Patrick. I really appreciate your answer.
You're most welcome. Thank you. I think we've got time to get to Parker in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Parker.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
I am well, thanks. We have about a minute.
Okay. Well, my question is, I have a friend who is atheist, and I just don't get what he believes. Can you explain why atheists believe what they believe?
Well, that would have to come from an atheist. It would be fairer for them to explain in their own words why they believe what they believe. But essentially, they deny the existence of gods, or whether it's the God that we believe in or any God for that matter, because they deny the existence of the supernatural order. So there is no heaven or hell. You don't have a soul. You didn't come from anywhere. You're not going anywhere after this life. There is no God or gods. All that exists is purely natural. So that's the fundamental premise that's built into the atheistic worldview. So if you're interested in how to refute that view, I would watch a great video by William Lane Craig debating Christopher Hitchens, the late atheist, called Does God Exist? It was a debate at Biola College in Southern California. You can look it up easily, and I think you'll find it very helpful. I'll be with you again tomorrow. Please pray for me. I'll pray for you.